Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
As is our custom, we'll go around and introduce ourselves first. My name is Ray Dyer.
Baruch.
Bob Sidokan.
Gary Pedler.
My name is Ari.
Johnny.
Chris.
Kay Matsuda.
Josh.
Randy.
Darren.
Paul.
Jay.
Howard.
Rich.
Leor.
Anthony.
Marvin.
David.
Ronnie.
Chris.
Carly.
Francisco.
Mike.
Jim.
Lee.
George.
Javier.
Don.
Lee.
Mark.
Lee.
Steve.
Jim.
Michael.
Richard.
Peter.
Scott.
Clint.
Bob.
Harv.
Jack.
Norman.
Juan.
David.
Jerry.
Rachel.
Patrick.
Mark.
Peter.
Larry Wish.
Everyone? Anyone here for their first or second time? Anyone? Welcome. Welcome. I'd like to remind people to speak to our newcomers and make them feel welcome. Today we have two members of our Sangha who are going to talk about their spiritual path. Peter Dell is a regular member of the GBF and a psychiatrist in residence. And Mark McClelland is a yoga teacher, massage therapist, and a regular member of the GBF. I'll let you guys introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Mark, and honored and nervous to be here. It's good to see you. I thought I would talk about my spiritual practice and path and some of the benefits that I receive from it, and hopefully some wisdom will come out of that. I think my practice consists mainly of meditation and yoga practice, and lately chanting. And we went to a chanting, a kirtan, like a night of chanting last Friday with Sean, who was here a few weeks ago. And it was great. It was kind of a high, you know. And that's one thing that I like about this path is that sometimes we get these just glimpses. It was a bit transcendent, you know, like beyond the mind and just the physicality of it and all that and the vocalizing of it. And, you know, I didn't know any of these people, you know, show up in someone's living room. They just moved into their house. It was very, very spare. And, you know, but we were bonded, and that was really nice. And that's part of what I get out of the spiritual practice is kind of that feeling of connectedness with people and with everyone. And it seems just to happen more easily when we sit together and all that. So, Part of it is just the experience. I think that maybe summarized my theme for my path. It's like I just kind of go with what feels true or what feels spiritual. And it's hard to describe. I think you all know there's some intuitive way that you know that something's right for you and right for me. And it seems a lot about the experience I have doing certain practices. And meditation surely... not every time, of course. They're sometimes very difficult. But just, I feel inch closer to discovering a little bit more about myself or about reality and moments of bliss. There's always the little carrot that kind of keeps me going. And these kind of transcendent feelings in the body and mind. So, kind of it's an overall theme. I got started meditation like 1991, I think, and it was It's a meditation center near my house, the Brahmakumara Center. And I thought, you know, I just needed this. I was feeling anxious. I was stressed out. I was working a lot. I had a life before. I was a massage therapist. That was a little more stressful job and commuting and all of that. And I just kind of needed relief from my own head. I mean, it really was just, I wasn't going crazy, but I just was busy and on in motion constantly. And it was a difficult time, you know, AIDS and all that. In 1990, I tested positive for HIV, which sort of threw my whole, you know, mental state out of whack and questioned what I was doing, why I was working so hard, and introduced a level of anxiety that I really had not felt before that. I was kind of cruising along in my happy little oblivious world and not really in my body, not having any sense of spirituality at all. So that was kind of a very dark time. It was a very dark time. It was totally a surprise to me to test positive. So I think part of my spiritual practice is grounded in relief of suffering, of the daily life that we have, of hardships that we have. And I really appreciated it at that time. At first it just felt like a break, you know, just like, okay, I can just breathe for half an hour, you know, like I don't have to deal with anything. And that's kind of how I started, and, you know, that was very nice. I really appreciate that. And to some extent today, it's a break too. You know, you really just want to drop in and chill out and, you know, let the mind settle. That's certainly a value to me today, but it was pretty much a coping strategy to start out. So I learned a lot about myself. It started to open up a lot of patterns in the mind of just old stuff came up, got into therapy and all that. And meditation and yoga practice was really an important part of that therapy. In fact, I started doing yoga. My therapist was a yoga teacher. And we started doing it in sessions just to, like, get me out of my head because I could spin all kinds of stories. In the last 5 minutes of the session, I got to, it's not anything real, you know, whatsoever. You know, I was sitting there, like, intellectualizing everything. And he said, don't you just breathe for a little bit? I'm like, well, okay. So I'm breathing and thinking about what I'm going to tell him next. You know, like, just on this, like, motion, like, always ahead. Always kind of ahead of where I really was, you know. It was just, what's that next thing? And so all that helped me just calm down and be real and cry or, you know, and feel, basically, because I really didn't know how to feel until that point. So that's why it's really, really dear to me in my life, not just as a practice, but it really helps me in life just to ground again and breathe and be reminded, just come back to center and just get some kind of peace, a little bit of peace. And out of peace, I'm trying to work on equanimity to kind of extend that off the cushion and just in the moment try to feel more peaceful or relaxed or at least deal, you know, without going into crazy or panic mode. And of course, I didn't pay attention to what time we started. Hopefully.
Doing fine.
Doing fine, okay. The word equanimity is really up for me now, and something I am hoping to get more out of the practice and have seen little glimpses of. I was on a retreat in a foreign country, in Mexico, and it was great, and I just wasn't feeling well, and I was, you know, running fever, and, you know, this aches, and it was crap. And, you know, so that's the reality. And then what the mind did is something to, you know, it's like, oh my God, I'm in the middle of nowhere. I don't have a doctor. I don't have anything, any support. Well, I had support. I had friends and everything. But like, oh my God, what am I going to do? You know, I could come home early. You know, the panic just sort of sets in, you know, and then the mind takes over. And I was this far from reality. And so what I got to was just being with what's happening in the moment, try to stay every moment in the moment. And it's like, okay, I'm just feeling tired. I'll just take a nap. You know, and just stay with that. And it was, I got to a place of accepting what was happening without any panic, without a story going on about it, you know. And that felt really big to me. That was a real separation that I had for the first time of, you know, what's really going on and seeing it clearly, what's going on, and not getting a step ahead of what was going on. And I'd like to grow more into that. I think it's not, you know, it happens and sometimes it doesn't happen. But that sense of equanimity of just staying in the experience without spinning a whole story about it. I have a little mantra. Imagine this person like an uncle or something. So this is it. You know, right there, this is it. Right now, this is what it is. You know, it's not what's happening in your head. It's what's happening, you know. And I, kind of a very friendly, but kind of, you know, speaks the truth all the time kind of uncle. It's kind of an imaginary, adult imaginary friend. It's very helpful. So keep coming back to the present. Keep coming back to what's really happening is what I try to do. So a little bit of yoga practice, too. That really helps me in that way. I practice Kripalu yoga, which is a mindfulness kind of yoga practice, and some slow, and there's time to feel and, you know, do the postures and all that. But one of the basic things that I love about it is it helps me examine my mind. Like, you're holding a posture, it gets intense, the mind is, you know, focused on the body, because if you don't, you're going to, like, fall apart. But it can be intense sometimes, but also it gives me an opportunity to separate the experience from the story and just sort of be there with my body and the breath and the mental chatter that comes up around that. I mean, it's like a meditation on the body instead of the breath or whatever tool we use when we sit. It extends into the physical, which for me is very important. You know, that's an important part of my practice, as some of you know. So it's just kind of brings me home, I guess, in a way that is very valuable. To just, again, be here and be with what's happening instead of going into some kind of mental trip about it. And I'm saying all this, too, because it's really up for me right now, in this moment, in this week, because I've got uncertainty around some health stuff, and it's all very kind of confusing, and symptoms arise and fall and arise again, and, you know, I'm going through a little trip with this and contact with doctors, and, you know, it's uncertainty, unclear, and of course the mental trip can go to the catastrophic, and it can stay in the present, and I'm really balancing that right now. And I would love to tell you that meditation works and I feel great. Not in every moment, you know, and you know, but it helps a lot. It helps to just stay with what's happening. Give me a second here. I think without my practice, this sense of anxiety would have gone on a lot longer before I practiced. And now I feel it and I acknowledge it and I have some distance from it that helps a lot. And it really helps me kind of get through in that way. I think another thing that's happened for me throughout the practice is it really has opened my heart in a big way. I really didn't have a relationship before I started sitting. I always had distance, you know, from people. And in general now, I feel very open and I feel very embracing of life and of people and have a great relationship for a long time now. I'm so grateful, really. I'm just incredibly grateful. The practice and it's created a community for me I never imagined, with people I really want to be with, all of you, other spiritual groups. In a way, it feels kind of like a coming out, like came out as gay, and it gave me a lot of freedom to just experience and just be myself. But I think that translated into the freedom to be more who I am altogether. And then discovering the spiritual practice was like even more, you know, I felt just so alive and present with it all. And I'm just feeling very grateful for communities around that. I have no idea what time it is.
I think you have a couple more minutes if you'd like.
A couple more minutes? Yeah. I think that's really, you know, a lot of what I wanted to say is just share that personal experience. And I also wanted to share, I'm just fascinated by the mystery of it, you know, what all the sages say and all the scriptures say and the Yoga Sutras and just these marvelous states of being. And I think every once in a while I dunk my head into it, you know, in a moment in meditation or connection, or sometimes I'm just like somehow pushed forward into the pool. But it's just the mystery of what lies beyond our bodies and our minds. It just fascinates me and keeps me coming back. So thank you for being so present and listening.
Thank you very much, Mark. That's so heartfelt. I think a lot of what I wanted to talk about overlaps, actually. So this is, and I've gotten to know both you and Ari, and forming the community has been really powerful for me for coming here. I wanted to. It looks a lot different from here, I have to say. I think everybody should try this at some point. It's really, I don't know. I'm usually looking at the Buddha or something, and there's so many happy, smiling faces out there. It's so wonderful. I wanted to talk a little bit about how I came to this room and then also talk about my practice a little bit that I currently have and share some things that have worked for me and some things I'm still struggling with. And my challenge for this has been to try and push it down to 20 minutes, which it can be difficult. I'll go, because I am a psychiatrist, I will go back to my childhood. a couple of things. My parents were very good in many ways and also have provided me with plenty of fodder for therapy for many years. One of the major things that they did well, I think, was they actually said to me when I was a child, "We're not going to push any religion on you. You are going to become an adult and you will decide." And that was great. And what I came to realize as a child, though, was that the morality part was not necessarily there for my parents. My parents have certain flaws, one of which is that they smoke. And when I was a child, it was taught smoking is horrible. And I thought, how can these people who are supposed to be providing me with morality tell me, you know, you don't need a religion? And I what that it basically got in me was this thought of, what if they're wrong? And it led me to think about all of the different ways to be moral, essentially. And I think when I was a child, and even into my teenage years, I was really struggling with, what is right? Who is going to tell me what is right? Because I really want to know what is right. And that externalization, some other things that happened, I found out when I was about 12 years old that my dad is gay. And the way I found out was actually because my brother and I had a conversation, and it turns out that my dad had been having sex with men. My parents were still married. And what? Where did that come from? What does that do? Which caused a lot of confusion and a lot of thoughts about, is being gay wrong? And around that same time, I was also starting to figure out that I was gay. I also learned to jerk off. And I remember feeling very... I wanted to bring this up because we are a gay Buddhist fellowship. We're not a regular Buddhist fellowship, but like sexuality for me has actually played a big part in me arriving here. And one of the things that came up with that was, if my parents are wrong, jerking off feels so good. It must be wrong. And thinking about... I had heard about Catholicism and heard that, you know, Catholics say that masturbation is wrong. And I'm like, what if they're right? What if I'm going to hell? A lot of this was alleviated when I took an amazing class when I was in high school. I had a hippy-dippy teacher named Hari Kallio. And as you can probably tell by his name, he was kind of children of hippies or himself as a hippie. And he taught a great religions class in my 11th grade. And we studied Christianity. We studied a little bit of Islam. We studied a lot of Buddhism. And it was really remarkable. That was my introduction to Buddhism. And I thought, wait a minute, here's a philosophy slash religion that doesn't tell me what's right. And that's really scary in some ways, but it's also really nice. And a key component for that was also there is no, as far as I can tell, no leap of faith. And that was something I had a very hard time doing. I remember going to my friends' churches and whatnot, and them saying, you have to believe that Jesus Christ is our Savior. And I thought, I don't know if that's true. How can I believe that? And they're telling me, you have to do that. If you're going to be a Christian, you have to believe this. And for me, I started, very early on, I intellectualized a lot. And what came up for me was, with Buddhism, there is essentially an intellectual challenge, which, from my understanding, the Buddha basically said, try out what I have to offer. This is not the only path. It is one path. Take what is helpful for you, and if it doesn't work for you, you don't have to do it. And that really appealed to me and still continues to appeal to me about Buddhism. So I took this class in high school. I went to college, and I was interested in Buddhism. And I took an Introduction to Buddhism course down at UCLA, taught by a guy who was a former Buddhist monk. And I remember, this is my last class at UCLA before I graduated, and I remember him saying to me, or I said, why did you not stay a monk? Why are you here teaching? And he said, I came to realize that I do not want to extinguish my own desire. And that stuck with me for a very long time. And in a way, I thought, I don't want to either. And I pushed away from Buddhism at that point and thought, that is not something I'm ready for at this point. And I didn't, now looking back, I don't feel like I had the bigger picture with it. Notes. So after that, I essentially put my spiritual path to the side. I thought, I'm an atheist slash agnostic. I don't really know what I'm going to do. And for a long time, spirituality was actually not something that was interesting or appealing to me. I wasn't compelled to pursue that at that point. And then I ended up following my intellectualization. I went to college and then to med school. And I graduated from med school last May, actually. And for me, med school is, I never imagined that I would have gone to med school. My parents didn't graduate college. And for me, the idea of going to college was essentially a big frivolous gesture. They said, why don't you just get a job? And so the idea of a graduate school or medical school in particular seemed outlandish. Why would I do that, you know? I got to med school, which for me was, in a way, the intellectual Olympics. And I thought, if I can, you know, if I can do this, then that means I'm X. And I didn't realize this all the time, but I think what it meant to me was, you are smart if you can do well in med school. You are a good person if you can do well in med school. And med school was quickly approaching an end, and I had done well in med school. And I thought, those feelings are still here. What the hell is going on? And again, sort of all of the energy that I had put up into my brain was, it was just up there, and I just realized that that was not necessarily something which was going to satisfy these needs. At about that same time, a friend of mine said, I want to start meditating, and there's an introduction to meditation class. And so last May, just about 15 months ago or so, I went to this class with her. And on the way there, I was talking faster than I'm even talking now, and I hadn't realized that I'd been in traffic. There was all this stuff going on, and I'm going to go meditate. All right, good. I've got this time scheduled. All right, we can go meditate, and then we can have fun afterwards. And I went to go meditate, and during meditation, thinking, this is doing nothing for me. Why am I doing this? And then afterwards, I was so much slower in such a good way. And on the way back, I allowed myself to slow down. And it was remarkable to feel a lot of that anxiety. And it's very similar to how you talked about, Mark, with how your anxiety is relieved by that, by meditation. And that was the first sort of glimpse at the power of meditation for me. Over the next few months, I meditated quite a bit. I actually was able to go to Costa Rica for 3 weeks. And while I was in Costa Rica, I was meditating a couple of times a week. And I had this experience of, at dusk, going out to a farmer's market in Costa Rica, and right after I had meditated. And it was my first experience, the first glimpse of that dunking of the head or the whatever you want to, however you want to conceptualize that. And I walked out there, and there was a farmer's market on the ocean, a warm ocean breeze. And as I walked out, there were incandescent light bulbs that didn't have the frosting on them. And just, I remember so clearly these sort of old trucks, and the fruits and vegetables were the brightest green and the brightest red. And they just were like singing to me. The colors and everything else was just singing to me. And it just, I, even now, as I'm talking about it, it brings up the hairs on the back of my neck. And it was just such an amazing experience. And I thought, I like this. Briefly to finish up how I got here was, then a couple months later, I was actually at the Castro Street Fair. And the Gay Buddhist Sangha actually had a booth there. And I picked up a little flyer and I signed up for their email list. And they have a book club as part of that. And one of the books that they were reading was called Buddhism Without Beliefs, which is actually, I highly recommend this book for anybody who's sort of the agnostic, atheistic realm. And I read that and really liked it. I then went to the Gay Buddhist Sangha, which meets at Sundays at 3 p.m., and 3 p.m. is my natural circadian rhythm nap time. And I had not fallen asleep in meditation before, and I fell asleep during that meditation. And then I had heard about this group, and I thought, I'll try the 10:30 group. And essentially, that's why I'm here. That being said, I am incredibly happy to be here because I feel like I connect and I have a community here that I... This is probably the most sort of religious thing I've ever done, to come and talk about my spirituality. A year ago, I never would have guessed that I would have been here doing this. So that's how I got here. My current practice is I try and meditate, and I never seem to meditate quite enough. And as one of the Sangha members here actually once told me, it's the important but non-urgent things like exercise and meditation that tend to go by the wayside. And that's the way I feel about meditation. There's never enough time. I've been able to sort of do it 3 to 4 times a week. Coming here is always grounding. A friend of mine, the same friend who took me meditation initially, has now invited me and some friends over on Monday nights or Thursday nights to meditate, and that's always fun. And we usually do something creative or artistic afterwards, which is also fun. And just trying to catch up with that. So just trying to meditate in that time. A couple of things that are helpful for me that I wanted to share is, one of them was a CD that I listened to about Tonglin meditation. And I don't know if any of you guys have heard about that. And I don't even know how to spell it because I just heard it. But it's this idea that it's in the moment when we experience negative things that we can respond to that, in a way of responding to that. One thing you can do is breathe in the negative energy and then breathe out purity. And another major thing, which was very appealing to me, was this idea that if you're feeling something that you are uncomfortable with, some sort of negative emotion, what you can do, the first step is recognition that other people feel this way. So if I am now feeling sad or incredibly anxious or heartbroken, it is very helpful if I can stop myself and say, other people feel this way. And just knowing that I'm not isolated in this world and that other people have felt this heartbreak or anxiety is incredibly helpful. There's another step you can take also, which is to say, may I feel this so that other people do not have to feel this way, which is also incredibly powerful. And to me, part of the sort of idea of universal love and that we are all connected, which is something that I truly believe. So part of my practice is trying to do that. It is very hard for me to remember to do that when I'm driving. Traffic is a major trigger for me, and I've had to really identify what is it that I'm attached to when I'm driving. And I say things that I would never say to somebody if I were walking down the street, sort of shaking my fist and cursing at them. And I think, where is this anger coming from? And so I try and remember to do that. Another thing that has been very helpful for me in the last month or two has been something that Robina Corwin said, I also recently got an iPod, and she's on Zencast, and I've been listening to some of her Dharma talks. And one of the things that she said that really struck me was how often we fall into this pity me or poor me place. And all of this ego that we have, all of this attachment, so often leads to us thinking about poor me. And I often hear my own, what I think of as my whiny voice. And now at this point, I can sort of say, I'm in a pity me mode. And what instantly came to me when I heard that was, what if this is a lucky me moment? And I try and do that now too. Just every time I hear that, pity me. Poor me. My boyfriend cheated on me. Poor me. I try and change that into a lucky me. I am so thankful that I've had this wonderful relationship. And I am hurting right now, and that is valid. But I am a better person for this. Things that are still a little bit of a challenge for me are how to live in what I consider an alarm clock society in Buddhist ways. And as a psychiatrist, I see therapy patients for 50 minutes, not the full hour, and having to keep my eye on the clock, I never want to do that. I want to be able to experience the flow of time. And trying to figure that out has been really hard. And another thing is trying to figure out what my intention is at this point for Buddhism. Because for me, it has been the most useful for calming down my mind, for stopping the racing thoughts, for giving me calm and clarity. And that is great, but I also, especially in the last month or two, have had several moments of experiencing that transcendence. And it has been scary at times, and it has been absolutely wonderful at times. And trying to figure out what it is that I want to do with that. And the last thing is that I challenge you all to ask yourselves, and I have my own answers, is just, we are a gay Buddhist sangha, or fellowship. And thinking about that, why are we here as gay people? And to me, I find it incredibly powerful and rewarding. But I think also when I've sat and listened to Dharma talks before, that has been sometimes part of what is missing, is why is it that we are here together? And that is just a question that I'm still trying to answer for myself. Part of me wishes that I could bring, that my friend Kate could be here, and she could, of course, and it feels welcoming, but it would just be, I feel like it would bring something different to it. So those are my thoughts. Thank you.
Do you want comments, questions?
Sure.
Yep, we have plenty of time for comments and questions.
Mark, can you tell a little bit about your teaching and its relationship to Buddhism?
Yeah.
You are a yoga teacher.
Yeah,
yoga classes. Yes, spaces classes. Just to tell us.
Thanks for the plug. But yeah, I see my yoga practice is really consistent with Buddhist practice, and yoga is really about the mind. You know, we do these things the body to kind of just settle our thoughts about what's for dinner and all that. But really, for me, you know, yoga practice is about the mind. Like the first three yoga sutras are, now is the time for yoga, meaning in the present moment. Yoga is the calming of the fluctuations of the mind. And the third is, when the mind is still, the seer abides in its true nature. So that sounds like meditation to me, or at least what I've heard about meditation. It's really calming the mind and doing that. And the practice, well, we know our practice. Don and I trained at the same school, so it's very liberating, this practice. You know, I talked about holding posture and letting the mind still, and the next phase of it is flowing with your deepest urges in the body. It's like a dance almost. It's like your mind is still, and we stimulate prana energy, and then you just start moving. And that feels very freeing. It feels very integrating of the body and mind together with heart, spirit. So,
how do you feel after your Torah class?
Great. I love it. People ask, oh, do you get tired? It's like, no, it's great. I would miss it if I didn't teach, you know. Teaching is just, you know, I'm a lifelong student first, of course. So, and then teaching is just a way of practicing what I learn, and hopefully someone gets something out of it. So.
Can I ask you the same question about your practice of psychiatry? You've not been practicing either one that long, so it must be a very interesting experience. How do you relate to that?
Absolutely. Being present for the clients / patients is really... people who, especially psychotic patients, know instantly. They have an amazing bullshit detector, and they can tell instantly when you are not there in the room with them. And psychotic patients, anecdotally, also are some of the most in the present people I've ever met. And it is actually really wonderful to work with a lot of them because there is no past or future for them. They are in the moment, sometimes in very damaging ways for them, which is sad to see, but sometimes they're just absolutely there. So having to be present and also doing psychotherapy, you absolutely have to be present in that room. You can't be thinking about your own past. You can't be thinking about your own future. You have to be listening intently, or else you're missing the boat. You're missing the moment. So, and in that way, I've actually really, like you say, it's invigorating to me to actually have the therapy patient. I don't feel tired or bored. And I mean, people used to tell me, "Oh, isn't it boring listening to other people's problems for 15 minutes?" And it's, there's always so much suffering, and how can you be, you know, distant from that? It, I don't know, I guess people can, but it's just being present in the moment.
Ray. I forgot your name.
Peter.
I was, thank you for your talk, both of your reflections. Very heartfelt. I was confused on your last point about the woman friend that you wanted to invite
right.
and couldn't or didn't, or I was confused
yeah.
by.
Yeah, absolutely.
I felt like you want to make a statement to us. And you tagged it right on the end. Strategically placed.
Absolutely. I think it has been, this might be my own crap coming up, absolutely, and I take responsibility. However, absolutely. Thinking about bringing a female friend here on a regular basis, I feel as though it might bring a different energy, and as though this necessarily, it feels a little bit like an exclusive club in a way, and I know that the door is open and anyone who wants to come in can come in. However, the space doesn't feel quite open enough for that, for me. And again, maybe that's my own stuff to bring up. Yeah.
Actually, I want to make a little comment and response to this dialogue, which I find really rich and wonderful. I've meditated for many, many years up in Spirit Rock on Wednesdays. And one of the things I saw in myself is, it was mostly women, and I found myself in the very beginning needing to identify myself as a gay man, in that context. I mean, it was mostly silent, but nevertheless, I needed to find a place to say, I'm here, and I'm gay. And it was always a mystery to me because it felt totally inappropriate. And it wasn't my first experience of being inappropriate, so. And one of the reasons I personally come here, and that this is important to me, is that over, I'm 65, so over a long period of time, I've come to discover that I need to address the woundedness and the suffering that is taking place inside of me as a gay man. And that one of the very best ways for me to do it is to be with other gay men, particularly not necessarily talking about our experiences, but just being. And the being is very rich. And I happen to love the fact that women do come on occasion. This is one of those cases that women do. And it's very rich for me. And it doesn't conflict or contradict also my need to have this part of me be so completely visible. Because it is true, when I do see other men here, I make an assumption. I do. It isn't always valid, but I do assume they're gay. They may not be. But that's my assumption. And I can connect them without ever saying a word or doing. So I appreciate your bringing those pieces on. That's really lovely. Another thing, I just want to address Mark for a second. Mark, I have loved doing restorative yoga with you. It's been a great treat. And I want to honor that. And part of that is that it's allowed me to be with my body wherever it is, no matter how. If there's pain or anything, it doesn't make any difference because I get to really be there and not have to change it. Mm. And that's such a wonderful gift. And so I want to thank you today for bringing pieces of you that are struggling too here. And it's such a wonderful, wonderful gift. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I think I saw Clint's hand first.
Yeah.
Well, I just had a question. Again, this is just to you, Peter. You mentioned something very briefly and moved on about the I want to make sure that I understood it correctly. I don't want to rephrase it in a way that wasn't what you were saying. But talked about the speakers that we've had here and how I understood your statement was it sounded to me like you said you wish there were more of like a Yeshua part into these Sangha talks. And first of all, is that what you were saying? How would you envision? I'm just curious if you want to just take that thought and run with it a little bit. What would your vision be along that line?
Well, part of me bringing this up was actually sort of to poke and provoke a tiny bit. I really love it here. So I guess part of it is just starting a dialogue. And part of it might just be one time when somebody comes in and the question is, why are we as gay men here? What does this need? I feel like so often it's been a little bit of an elephant in the room, and here we are getting Dharma talks. And Dharma talks, and usually it's sort of brought up of, I'm so happy to be here in a room full of gay men and whatever else, but sort of, what is that about? What, and just maybe something, and it could even be breaking down into discussion groups, might be something of that nature. I really have enjoyed the sort of democratic with a non-capital D idea of the Sangha, and the fact that we break down and we talk in little groups, and everybody contributes, and there's a facilitator, and there's not a, preacher or something like that. I really enjoy that part of it. So that would probably be something that I would envision would be just some sort of discussion at some point. It wouldn't have to be every week. I love the Dharma talks that we have. So, but just once in a while to say, what is this? I think
as a scientist, are you doing any neurofacing with the ideas that come from neuroscience, for example, as Wes Nisker presented last week and other times? Does that interest you at all?
Absolutely, absolutely. Another thing that Mark brought up that I meant to mention was this idea of the second arrow, which I think somebody else had brought up some 6 or 8 months ago or so. And this idea that, from my understanding, the Buddha taught that if we are struck by an arrow, that is the first arrow. And then it's the stories that we create about that arrow, which is the second arrow. And most of the time, it's the second arrow that is far more damaging. And the reason I bring that up is because recently, and I apologize if somebody brought this up here because I'm getting my psychiatry stuff confused sometimes with my Buddhist stuff. Yeah, exactly. In many ways, yes. And this idea that somebody looked at the amount of morphine that was needed for soldiers who were struck on a battlefield in World War II versus people who were shot in Baltimore at the same time. And it was, they needed half of the dose of morphine if they were shot on the battlefield of World War II. And that is not because they were skimpy with the morphine. They said, how much morphine would you like? And they gave it to them and whatever else. And the reason was the second arrow. Because in the case of the battlefield, the second arrow was, I get to go home. And in the case of being in Baltimore, it is, my life is ruined. Here I am, I'm injured, I'm not going to be able to get back to my normal life. And so that interface of sort of our opiate needs in our brain are actually different based on the second arrow. That's, fascinating stuff.
Well, I kind of wanted to respond actually to someone's comment about Buddhism and psychotherapy being the same thing. And it's really not, because if you look at Buddhism, it happens in a specific historical and cultural context. And so when you're looking at Buddhism from our point of view, which is from American 21st century point of view, we look at things from in a way that's very influenced by psychology, by Freud, by Jung, by cognitive behavioral theories. But I mean, some of Buddhism does have observations about human psychology and human behavior, but some of it should not be interpreted in that way. And you kind of see that more as you study the history and the cultures that Buddhism comes from. and the reason why certain monks took certain positions, sometimes for political reasons, actually. So it's kind of important to recognize that.
I have a question for both of you, and you each alluded to it in different ways. How have you reconciled your drive for desire or passion as you move down this Buddhist path?
Passion is good. I'm not sure. Clarify what you mean by the drive or passion.
It was Peter who alluded to that about his professor, mm-hmm. Who didn't want to reject desire, I guess. Yeah. And then for you, Mark, I think you alluded to the fact, I'm using passion in the most broadest of sense, since you've become practicing, meditating more and more, you've opened yourself to much more in terms of human relationship and experience.
Yes, I think before I had more fixed ideas of where I was going, and just meditation practice and more present, I'm open to seeing more of what could happen. I think that some of the drive, I think, is that you're referring to, is sort of almost like blinders or something, and then now it's more experience that I can take in from places I didn't know that I could get it from. Does that get into your question?
Sure.
I think for me, it is still something that comes up, and I have not been able to let desire go. Still, I think Buddhism does a couple of different things. One is it gives me conscious recognition of what I'm doing. So if I'm going to do something which I know is not the healthiest, at least I know that it's not healthy, but I still choose to do it at that moment. A friend of mine used to phrase this as, if you're going to have the donut, like, just know that you're having the donut, and the donut is not a substantial meal. And so part of that is doing what therapy is supposed to do, which is bring the unconscious into conscious. So, because that gives us more choices. So that's one thing that it does. But sometimes I want that donut. And there's nothing you can say or do to change my mind. I'm going to have that goddamn donut. And so that's one thing. It also makes me focus on what the object is. Instead of desiring the attachment, I can desire the object, if that makes sense. So that and what that really means for me is that on a day-to-day basis, instead of, for example, relationships are hard for me. And in a relationship, what it's been able to have me do is live in the present moment and not be attached to what I think is the future. And that is incredibly helpful. So instead of saying, I have desire for this future, this perfect future together, I am having desire satisfied in this present moment with this person. I think Jack had
I just had two, I guess, a comment and then a question, both about context. One is the GBF context, since I've been here for quite a while. One of the great things about GBF is that it's a living and constantly renewing and changing truth, and it exists because everybody wants it to. There have been energetic discussions about women. in the past 2 or 3 years ago, I think there were several. And it wasn't particularly resolved. And some guys really love the idea of a wider group of people here, and some people have some real problems with women. So being a part of GBS, so it wasn't resolved, but it has been discussed. Maybe, since it seems about half of you have come since then, it might be time to revisit that. The other is a context question for Mark. Since I don't know you that well, I just wonder a little bit what your background was. Not maybe explicitly your biography of dates, but of born, raised, and college. But what was your background that got you to the point of being open and ready and seeking for meditation?
Yeah, I'm a native of the Bay Area, I know the whole story, but I think it was really sort of a point of crisis that brought me to the cushion, you know. I think my head was going to explode with what was happening in my life, and it was a good support. So that's kind of what got me here. I had a huge life change at that point. I was working a lot. I'd always been type of drive, and now I'm kind of sifting that through. And thank you for what you said, Peter. It's like just an attachment to money, progress. You know, totally. You know, I had no idea who I was. You know. I thought I was self-actualized when I could carry a briefcase. You know, I didn't feel as good. I tell you, I'm so different now. I can't even believe it. Go to high school reunions, and you know, we're all very friendly and loving towards each other. And then you know, I start talking about yoga, and you know, they're doing their lives, and they're really wonderful, heartfelt people. And it's like, but that's their time of life. Is this that drive still? And I kind of like, you know, took a step off the track. So that's part of what got me here. And then. The rest, who knows?
Well, I guess it's the role of psychiatrists to raise questions, as I understand it. And so you brought up two of them. One was about, they're sort of related, one was about gayness and the other was about women. And I wanted to comment at least briefly on that. I've had problems, and so the answer is I see it. It actually comes from 12-step fellowships, among other places. Progress, not perfection. And there have been two rounds of disputes about women. And the first one, they were both acrimonious to some degree. The second one, less so. And the first one was, should women be allowed? And that was not resolved. And then the second one, there was no longer any doubt that women should be allowed. It was the question, should we change the name and should they actually be encouraged? So it's gone along. And the same kind of thing, I believe, has happened about sexuality, in which it was the forbidden topic. And I know I presumably other people would raise questions, well, how does this relate to the sexuality? And there'd be silence. And now it's sort of come along more. The thing that I would like to see us work more on is having these disputes, and we've just gone through another one by email about HEPA microloans. I'd like to see them be less acrimonious.
Thank you.
And as I understand it, from what I've read, Buddhist monks, they have fierce disputation, kind of like debates, but the goal is not to have unkindness in that. In the process, so and also just for myself, I'm one of the people that really wanted women to be welcome, and I actually left GBF for a while because I found partly the issue, but more the tenor of it so uncomfortable. And you know, I've made progress also. So sort of like, this is just part of stuff that happens. So thank you for raising that.
I'd like to say something quickly, addressing the gayness of the Sangha. The reason I appreciate this, or one of the reasons I appreciate the Sangha, is that we are gay men, we are identified as gay men, and I feel like we share a common background of suffering in some way. And at least that's the story I tell myself, you know, we share this common background of suffering growing up in the society that we did. And it's comforting for me to come to a place where I feel like, you know, I'm like all the others. I'm not different, and I like that. The other part of it is that this Sangha, to me, is more about building some kind of personal connections and relationships, which I think in other gay men's groups, I don't get that feeling. And in other Buddhist sitting groups, I don't get that feeling, and that's what draws me here, is that, you know, that combination of, you know, being involved personally in the Sangha. I also think it's very rare for 40 or 50 gay men to sit together in silence for 30
minutes.
Did somebody, Larry?
maybe this is kind of like a thank you for both of you speaking. Mark, I know you better, and Peter, I'm really glad. I think that this opportunity helps to make community. The idea that we can share whatever we would like for 20 minutes in any style that we like in front of the other people, this is how you build Sangha. This is how you have some sense of who the other people are. I'm curious to talk with both of you about quite a number of things. There's not enough time as I stand here, but I'm glad that I have the opportunity and the starting points. I find, partially, I love the fact that this is a gay group and that one of the reasons I come, but I also find gay groups to be socially challenging to me for quite a number of reasons. And I like, that challenge. So I'm delighted to get to know both of you a bit better, and I encourage anyone, I think everyone here should have the opportunity and to take the opportunity to have the seat in the front and to tell something about yourself to us. It's really a wonderful gift both ways.
It's
Peter,
not as scary as it sounds.
Peter's been raising his hand.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, Peter, and I don't want to pry too much, but since you're a psychiatrist, perhaps. I think you've said that you've been through one or two boyfriends since you came to the Sangha. I'm very interested in the whole question of the kind of support that the Sangha offers. I came here with a background prior to it of 12-step work, and I found, for me personally, finding my own balance around intimate relationships, around one-on-one relationships, involved also being able to get nurturance from a group, from a relationship that was not so focused on immediate gratification or sexual gratification. And I think that's part of the tension that exists here when you put so many gay men together. It's sort of like, well, what kind of pleasure are we really offering each other? And so I went out and tried to find a speaker on spiritual friendship, and she turned out to be sort of a little nun and didn't really talk a lot about the things that gay men are interested in. but that idea of spiritual friendship to me is very important, because I think there is a kind of natural sustenance that we offer each other. It's almost like a little convention of nurses or something. We all seem to know each other's weak points, and we can, of course, be quite vicious about it, and that has happened here at times, but we can also be very nurturing. And so, you mentioned the example of the donut, wanting the donut, and, are you attached to the donut? And sometimes I felt like individual relationships are sort of like donuts, but being in the Sangha is sort of like a power bar. So, having been through a little bit of history and having your background as a psychologist, have you seen the Sangha sort of recede and come forward in terms of its, I guess I'm talking now like a gestalt there, but have you seen the importance of the Sangha, or the luminosity, the aura of the Sangha sort of change as your relationships have changed? Has that been, does that reveal something to you about what the Sangha offers?
Absolutely. Just to clarify for the record, I have had one boyfriend, but we've been on again, off again several times. So sorry for any confusion. Not that I'm sensitive about that or anything. For me, I can think of a lot of different analogies for it. One is that I know that when I've had a crappy week, I can always come here, and I always leave feeling better, and I always leave feeling more connected. And I will answer my own question about why I enjoy being in a group of gay men, and it is very similar to Ray's, actually. I like being in a group of gay men that is not centered around drinking or drugs or so many of the other distractions that there are in the world. And we are all here because we don't agree on everything, certainly, but we're like-minded in so many different ways. And for me, this community is bigger than any one of us. So every week, we can come here, and there will be other people here. And some of us will die soon, unfortunately, and other of us will continue. I, at one point, will not be a part of the Sangha. I get busy with other stuff, but every week, it is consistency. It is a reminder that I am part of something bigger. And when I am lost in the donut frenzy I can come back and be reminded of that. And for me, very much relationships are the donut analogy. I mean, they are so satisfying in so many ways, but I oftentimes get a bellyache later. And coming here, you're right. I mean, I like the power of our analogy too, but I think it's really just the sense of constancy and community that is so valuable for me.
This is a really rich topic, and we could go on, but I just want to acknowledge that it's noon. No, it's up to the group if we want to continue with a couple more questions or wrap it up.
I personally wouldn't mind. I speak for myself, obviously. I personally wouldn't mind a few more minutes.
Okay. How many people are opposed to continuing for a couple more questions? Okay. Well, let's continue.
I was wondering if we could create some. I think someone said that it would be a good idea if we kind of talk further about the whole women issue, and also about your issue about what does it mean for us as gay men to come to this practice. Is there a way for us to all kind of decide democratically right now what would be the best way to talk about it later?
Democracy takes time.
when we break up into smaller groups next time, could that be the topic that we talk about? Would that be the best way to kind of, I just don't want it to die, like the question to kind of die out and get not dealt with later.
Ray, if I could respond to that just real quick. I'm chair of the program committee, and the program committee is responsible for speakers, subjects and topics and themes. And we're also preparing this fall to have a one-day retreat of the program committee in which we're going to consider themes for reflection, for Dharma talk, and for Sangha evaluation. I wanted to ask the program members who are here today if you can raise your hand. Baruch and Darren and Peter and myself really encourage you to communicate with us about your thoughts and feelings, interests. We're always looking for new speakers to address new topics. So the conversation here certainly has been heard and will be considered as a part of the agenda for reflection.
Okay.
And appreciate what we're constantly soliciting from the Sangha, your visions, your ideas, and new speakers.
Are your meetings open? When?
Meetings can always be open.
Do we have a host?
I didn't quite mean to have it like this, but yes. So welcome to the new members, and Chris, I believe. And again, please try and make Chris welcome. It was not hard for me to feel welcome here. There are tea and refreshments. There are non-vegan bread products. There's a chocolate babka and some banana bread out there. And there is what I hope is some vegan fruit, some figs and some pineapple out there. If you do drink tea, please rinse out your cups and leave them to dry. I will also be passing around a purple Donna bowl. And the suggested donation is $5 to $8. And if you can give more, please do. If you can't give that much, don't feel obligated. There's also a sign-up sheet for newcomers, which is located on sort of the back wall, and there are also some copies of the newsletter there. Please include your mail address as well as your email address in those cases, because it's my understanding we're trying to email as many of the newsletters as possible to save on paper. Sometimes there is lunch afterwards, and I am unable to go to lunch today, but if there is usually kind of a critical mass that meets outside about 12:30, so if you're interested in getting in touch with some Sangha members. And that's it.
Any other announcements?
I have these shirts that I'm giving away. It says Stop Genocide in Sudan. So I have them in green, black, and brown. I'm not sure about what sizes are available, but if anyone wants a free t-shirt, it's kind of political. And what is your name? The woman?
Rachel. Me? Rachel.
Yeah. Oh, I just wanted to acknowledge you because you're a new member, I'm assuming.
Or just visiting. Thank
oh, just visiting. But I wanted to acknowledge you.
I'm coordinating. The Sangha has a prison outreach project, part of our social engagement with the world. And we periodically meet and review letters that we receive from prisoners, and today we're meeting. And so I would appreciate if there were some people who could stay and read the really interesting letters that we get from prisoners. Probably we'll meet just at that table right outside, and probably for about 20 to 30 minutes.
Any other?
Very soon you'll be hearing, hopefully you'll be getting some publicity and information about the Iraq moratorium. It's a national movement that's in the planning stages, and I think it's a lot of publicity will come out on the 1st. It's basically asking everybody on the 21st of September to simply wear a black armband. And I think we may be able to, I might be able to get some black armbands for people. Or you can just, as somebody said, rip off the top with an all black shirt, put black sock and put it on your own. And the other thing, Howard, is that nationally they're asking that spiritual groups, since it's a faith-based initiative, from on the weekend of the 13th to the 14th, have a brief 10-minute memorial, maybe reading some names or doing something like that, just to bring into our consciousness, you know, the Iraq. So the moratorium has the spiritual component, and then it has the day we can individually observe it wherever we are. I'm on the planning committee for San Francisco.
Any other announcements?
Me? Thank you, Clint. My name is Ari. There is a group of us that meets to meditate Tuesday evening in San Francisco. So if you want more information, see me afterwards.
My name is Clint. I just want to announce a project that we've become involved with that became, unfortunately, more controversial than I anticipated it being. We've made a donation to Kiva.org, which extends microloans to third world people in third world countries that are trying to start businesses and be self-sustaining. So I'm not here to restart this controversy, which was on the Yahoo site and unfortunately pretty acrimonious. But I just want to let people know we've done that, interested in it. It's kiva.org, and you can see we have seven different people we've donated to, and you can see our donations in our biography there.
I think you should just say that it was a group decision to do this. It's not your decision. You're simply communicating what, but for, so you did the work of getting it out there. But it was a group decision, and also mentioned it, the Sangha, before we actually understood.
I was unfortunately given a lightning bolt personal attacks. It was unfortunate that happened.
Okay, any other announcements? You can stand and join the hands.
By the power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness which is without sorrow, and may all live in equanimity without too much attachment or too much aversion, and live believing in the equality of all that lives.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month, and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.